Hello and welcome to Smithsonian Magazine. This is Sue Johnson reading from the March 2026 issue. Today I'll be reading some shorter stories. The first one is called You Sly Dog, How a Plucky, Portable, Infinitely Adaptable Sausage Stole the Heart of the Whole Doggone Country. It's written by Rebecca Toy. It was hardly a typical state dinner. On June 11, 1939, George VI of England attended a picnic retreat at President Franklin Delano Roosevelt's residence in Hyde Park, New York, where the king, for the first time in his life, tasted a hot dog. The treats arrived on silver platters. After polishing off his first dog, the king went back for a second, and Washington, D.C.'s Times Herald celebrated this expression of Anglo-American solidarity. Today we can bellow down the Coney Island boardwalk, our voices uplifted in pride that the hot dog truly makes the whole world kin. The hot dog's great success has always transcended class, wrapping the modern history of the United States into a portable bun. It all began with the 5 million German immigrants who arrived in two large waves from 1830 to 1890, during one of the Industrial Revolution's periods of rapid urbanization. The first hot dogs, then called Frankfurters or Wienerwursts, likely emerged in the mid-19th century when German immigrants started selling bun-wrapped sausages from push carts with coal-fed fireboxes in New York City's Bowery. These simmered or steamed sausages that had special old-world snap. Finely ground pork or beef stuffed into a natural casing that popped with the first bite, a sensation that hot dog purists still seek. Portable and tantalizingly inexpensive, these street eats were designed for teeming cityscapes. By the 1870s, more than 25,000 weekend visitors flocked to the sunny beaches, hand-carved carousels and vaudeville performers on Coney Island's sandy paths, and later, boardwalks. In the next decades, as factories and mills joined banks and department stores in offering workers a half holiday on Saturdays, more and more folks came to enjoy the seaside on the weekends, and they required cheap eats. It was on the boardwalk that the hot dog began to secure its spot on the American menu. Charles Feltman, a baker and a streetcar vendor, is widely credited with popularizing the sausage in a bun formula. In 1893, at the World's Columbian Exposition in Chicago, better known as the World's Fair, introduced millions to this handy treat. And by the end of the century, hot dog vendors were bustling about racetracks and America's beloved baseball fields. While there is a heated debate over the origins of the name, and though dachshunds are often invoked, historian Bruce Craig argues persuasively that it's actually a result of the sausage's popularity among the youth. Hot dog was already slang for a swaggering young man who loitered with other flashy dandies around public amusements and gobbled up sausages from vendors. The slang spread, and by the time Nathan Handwerker, Feldman's Coney Island protege, started Nathan's Famous in 1916, hot dog was ubiquitous. By the turmoil of the 1930s, the hot dog conjured the sense of simple but satisfying life that might lie within reach, even amid the Great Depression. On February 10, 1931, national papers printed Walt Mason's Ode to the Lowly Life, in which the columnist declared in a verse, quote, "I find life far more delicious in my humble hot dog stand, for the men in lofty places stir resentment everywhere. Someone longs to punch their faces. Someone yearns to pull their hair." End quote. The hot dog also nourished American ideals amid the patriotic fervor of World War II. In November 1941, a reporter from the Detroit Free Press marveled at the wiener's journey. A hot dog may have a long Teutonic ancestry, but from White House to hovel, he's a thoroughly naturalized American now without a single Nazi sympathy. Post-war prosperity meant carnivorous Americans could and did turn to other meats, and the hamburger muscled in as the new diner darling. Yet hot dogs remained at the center of American open-air rituals, from the new suburban backyard barbecues to nights at the drive-in. And there was always baseball. A proverb coined by one of the era's biggest movie stars, Humphrey Bogart, captures an American truth. He said, "A hot dog at the game beats roast beef at the Ritz." The hot dog has proved infinitely adaptable. As baseball traveled south of the border, the classic ballpark dog took a trip to Hermosilla, Mexico, in the 1970s, and returned a decade later as the Sonoran dog, now wrapped in bacon and buried under pinto beans, onions, tomatoes, and jalapenos. Even the meat was not sacrosanct, with tofu pups and soy boy not dogs widely hitting markets early in the 1980s for the rising health-conscious movement. In the 1990s, Hollywood's famous Pink Hot Dogs restaurant introduced topping combinations based on celebrities' preferences, like the Rosie O'Donnell, which was chili, mustard, onion, and sauerkraut, or the Drew Barrymore. She likes a jalapeno dog with chili, mustard, onions, cheddar, and three slices of bacon. While modern purists balk at such liberties, doubling down on arguments about the acceptability of skinless dogs and ketchup, there's always a place for the dirt-cheap hot dog. Costco built a whole business model around that very nostalgia. Its quarter-pound all-beef hot dog, served with a large drink, has famously stayed inflation-proof at $1.50, though it wasn't easy. In a 2018 interview, then-CEO Craig Jelenk recounted a showdown with the company's co-founder, Jim Senegal. "I said, 'Jim, we can't sell this hot dog for $1.50. We're losing our rear ends.'" Senegal purportedly responded that if Jelenk raised the price, "I will kill you. Figure it out." They switched from Hebrew National and started making their own Kirkland signature dogs, and the problem was polished off. And that's the end of that story called "You Sly Dog." Just as a side note, I have a friend who lives near New York City, and she says that they call the street vendors selling hot dogs, she says they call them dirty water dogs. Anyway, here's a side story that goes along with the hot dog story. It's called "A Selective History of Gorging." Humans have long sought to turn gluttony into a virtue, leading to some remarkable episodes of competitive eating. This is written by Sonia Anderson. A hair-raising appetite. In the 17th century, an English farmer named Nicholas Wood was seen devouring 60 eggs and a quarter of a lamb. It was a routine meal for Wood, who was known as the Great Eater of Kent. According to the poet John Taylor, Wood once consumed 7 dozen rabbits in one sitting, a feast Taylor estimated would have fed 168 soldiers. Whenever Wood ate publicly at fairs and festivals, nobles delighted in betting on his stomach. By the end of Wood's life, he had just one tooth left. He'd lost most of the others while eating an entire mutton, shoulder, bones, and all. The weight of the Union. The late 19th century begat colorful associations formed on the basis of poundage, which became known as fat men's clubs. These groups disallowed any man under 200 pounds and hosted celebratory weigh-ins and socials. Unsurprisingly, the organizations spent much of the dues they collected on food. At one meeting, the New England Fat Men's Club feasted on oysters, cream of chicken soup, boiled snapper, beef with mushrooms, roasted chicken, roasted piglet, shrimp salad, fruit pudding, cheese, cake, and ice cream. Dogged efforts. In May 1972, Nathan's Famous, Coney Island's renowned hot dog restaurant, held its first hot dog eating contest. Local competitors stepped up to swallow as many wieners and buns as they could in 3.5 minutes. And a Brooklyn College student named Jason Schechter won by downing 14 dogs. In the half century since, standards have skyrocketed. The current record belongs to Joey Chestnut, who took home Nathan's coveted mustard belt in 2021 after eating 76 hot dogs in 10 minutes. Chestnut's methods is to break each hot dog in half, dunk the bun in water, and establish a rhythm. Meat, bun, swallow, breathe. Parlor tricks. In 1976, Chicago's Dr. Jazz Ice Cream Parlor announced that it would hold a Sunday eating competition, and eaters flocked from all over. One competitor from New York City prepared by jogging, having his throat massaged, and swabbing his pharynx with mineral oil. He had the wrong idea. Chicagoan High Polanski, the contest's sexagenarian winner, simply trained by eating. His preparation began in childhood when he purportedly ate 4 pints of ice cream per day. At Dr. Jazz's, Polanski put away 3 gallons of vanilla ice cream, a pint of hot fudge, a quart of whipping cream, and 1 cherry in 20 minutes. And that's the end of the history of gorging. Now moving on to another story on a completely different topic. This one is called A Striking New Tactic. When automotive workers in Flint sat down at their jobs and stood up for workers' rights. It's written by Luke Savage. As the clock struck noon on January 11, 1937, roughly 100 men camped on the second floor of a Flint auto plant suddenly found themselves without heat. Under normal circumstances, there might have been 1,000 workers inside the Fisher No. 2 facility, bustling to produce auto bodies, sending 450 of them to a Chevrolet assembly facility across the road every 24 hours. But the day's more austere climate owed itself to decidedly unusual circumstances. On December 30th, the men inside the plant had joined the fellow workers in a daring strike action with the aim of forcing a reluctant General Motors to recognize their union, the United Auto Workers, the UAW. Eschewing the traditional method of picketing outside, their primary chosen tactic, the sit-down strike, was as disruptive as it was rare. As Greg Zipes, an attorney who teaches at the New York University's School of Professional Studies, has written, workers stay at their workstation to prevent any other workers, presumably non-union strikebreakers, from taking their place. Because the processes involved in automobile production were so tightly integrated, relatively small numbers of workers placed at strategically chosen choke points could effectively paralyze production even at an industrial leviathan like GM. Since the sit-down had begun, the thousands of strikers had passed the time in relative peace, undisturbed by GM management and the police. But feeling a sudden burst of winter air at midday, the workers realized something was afoot. Sure enough, the company had switched off the heat, and company guards outside were also blocking the delivery of food, marking the first in a series of escalations that culminated in a violent clash that night. When police arrived to relieve the beleaguered guards, they began hurling tear gas and eventually fired bullets and buckshot at the strikers. The workers replied in kind with water from fire hoses and ad hoc projectiles. It was like a war or revolution, a union photographer who witnessed the melee recalled. With broken glass and lumps of coal and hinges from Chevrolets. At least 9 police and 14 strikers were injured. Most of the latter suffered bullet wounds. receiving the news of the battle a little over 50 miles away at his office in Lansing, Michigan's newly inaugurated governor, Frank Murphy, promptly decided to intervene. Accompanied by State Police Commissioner and the Adjutant General of its National Guard, he set out to visit Flint. In any other state, Murphy's arrival might have easily been the prelude to an even more dangerous confrontation. But in Flint, once word reached the auto workers that Murphy was en route and planned to send in troops, the atmosphere was one of jubilation. The governor was interceding on their behalf. With the clash still raging, 25-year-old organizer Victor Ruther, then outside the buildings in a car with an exterior sound system, seized on the news to taunt the police. "You'd better go home before Governor Murphy gets after you." Ruther's optimism was soon to be vindicated. On Murphy's orders, a throng of armed guardsmen arrived the next morning and took up positions outside the occupied factories to create a buffer between the strikers and local authorities. Officially, according to the governor's neutrally worded public statements, the troops' role was simply to preserve order and prevent further violence. Unofficially, their deployment represented an unprecedented political intervention on the side of organized labor and ultimately enabled the auto workers to defeat one of the world's largest corporations and score a monumental union victory that would help define American labor relations for decades to come. When workers at the two Flint GM plants had abruptly gone idle at their machines and refused to move in December 1936, they ignited an industrial dispute in the automotive heartlands of Michigan that quickly spread to plants in Toledo, Ohio, and Janesville, Wisconsin. Lasting 44 days and involving some 136,000 workers, the strike had been decades in the making. Well before the mid-1930s, Flint was an important center of industrialization. As a leading producer of carriages in the 19th century, it was already an established hub of transport manufacturing by the time GM was founded in 1908, earning the moniker Vehicle City. The ensuing decades saw a boom for American cars as new factories sprang up and vehicles streamed off the assembly lines in ever greater numbers. And sales accordingly increased nearly 25-fold between 1910 and 1929. Flint's population exploded too, rising to 156,492 by 1930, roughly 12 times its population when the century began. GM, in turn, soon grew into a global spanning industrial colossus. And by the mid-1930s, it had more than 60 plants across 14 states. The cars and trucks produced by its 171,711 hourly workers accounted for an astonishing 37% of all global sales. Like most of their fellow industrial workers in the 1930s, though, the company's laborers received no sick benefits, pension plans, or paid time off, and they lacked basic job security. In stark contrast to many of GM's white-collar and managerial staff, whose employment often came with insurance and sick pay. Industrial work could be incredibly dangerous, and safety precautions were virtually non-existent. One Buick metalworking shop was so prone to injuries that it was nicknamed the Slaughterhouse. Things worsened with the Depression, which created an unemployment pool so vast that GM could and did treat its workers as more or less disposable and fired them at will. Wages were paid out only if the line stayed running, and the company sometimes punished workers with cuts to their hourly pay for failing to meet quotas. Working conditions were atrocious, one former employee reflected to a BBC documentary crew several decades after the strike. The line was so fast, you didn't have time to go to the restroom. When he got home after work, I would clean up and go to bed. I couldn't even eat. I was that tired. Yet against this bleak backdrop, the political ferment of the emerging New Deal era saw both a growing climate of worker militancy and a newfound pro-labor bent among some of the country's leading Democratic politicians. Signed into law by President Franklin D. Roosevelt in 1935, the National Labor Relations Act established a legal framework for unions. Though amid legal challenges by big employers, the legislation rested on shaky ground, and actually, organizing a union, especially in the automotive sector, remained incredibly difficult. GM was determined to crush even the thought of any collective action. And through the mid-1930s, it surveilled its employees so aggressively that a subsequent congressional inquiry dubbed its contract with the Pinkerton Detective Agency as a monument to the most colossal super system of spies yet devised in any American corporation. Despite the company's best efforts to cover up such espionage, GM official Merle Hale conceded as much, saying in his testimony before a 1937 Senate committee that he had retained the Pinkerton agency because he wanted to know the source of labor dissatisfaction, as well as monitor meetings with labor organizers and track criticisms of management. Working under another labor group, the Committee for Industrial Organization, the CIO, the fledgling UAW, launched an organizing drive in the summer of 1936, but found only modest success. Its efforts, however, were soon buoyed by Roosevelt's landslide reelection in the November presidential contest, and, closer to home, by the concurrent election of Democrat Murphy as Michigan's governor. A lawyer of Irish descent and a devout Catholic with an innate sense of justice, Murphy had campaigned aggressively for labor support and arguably owed his own narrow victory to workers' votes. While other Democratic governors, like Ohio's Martin L. Davey, had no qualms about deploying troops against striking workers, Murphy proved remarkably resistant to repeated calls for the use of force, even as the UAW made use of the radical and disruptive sit-down tactic. From GM's point of view, the sit-downers were illegally trespassing, plain and simple. In this spirit, the company duly secured an injunction from the State Circuit Judge Edward D. Black for their removal. But Murphy refused to enforce it. When GM escalated by cutting off the heat at Fisher No. 2 on January 11th, the governor responded by making his most consequential and fateful intervention in the strike. Murphy demanded that the company restore heat in the plants and ordered Michigan's Welfare Department to provide direct food aid to the striking workers. And while Murphy played a role of neutral mediator in public, he effectively sided with the union by deploying the National Guard as a buffer, privately telling UAW organizer Robert Travis and CIO leader John Lewis that the troops would protect the strikers inside and outside the plants and prevent their ejection. Even by the pro-labor standards of the New Deal era, Murphy's conduct during the strike made him an outlier among Democratic governors. With sit-downs protected, the union was soon able to go on the offensive with a daring feint. On February 1st, workers at Flint's relatively insignificant Chevrolet No. 9 facility launched a mock sit-down action that lured GM guards to converge on the scene, enabling other workers to blockade themselves inside the more strategically valuable Chevrolet No. 4, which made engines for Chevrolets. We have the key plant of the GM, and the eyes of the world are looking at us, one worker who participated in the action wrote in a letter to his wife. We sure done a thing that GM said could never be done. Served with a new court injunction ordering them to leave the occupied plants, the workers held their ground, and on the morning of February 3rd, their ranks swelled as fellow UAW members and other supporters came in from Detroit and Toledo in a mass gesture of solidarity. By the afternoon, some 3,000 picketers had assembled outside Fisher No. 1 as other strikers occupied Flint's main arterial road and paraded through its downtown. Amid this show of strength, GM soon had no choice but to yield. On February 11th, having produced a mere 151 cars in the United States since February 1st, the company capitulated and officially pledged to recognize the UAW in a signing ceremony presided over by Murphy himself. Victoria's workers streamed out of their factories and formed a triumphant procession. They marched and they sang and they danced all night long in the streets of the city of Flint. It was the biggest, most important corporation in the world being challenged, and successfully challenged, by labor, says Nelson Lichtenstein, a labor historian at the University of California, Santa Barbara. It was unquestionably the most consequential strike of the 20th century. Once they win in Flint and they have signed a contract, hundreds of thousands of workers pour into the UAW, and other managers, other capitalists, say, okay, if the most important company in the world is signing with a union, well, maybe we better do it too. Thinking back nearly 40 years later, one retired worker explained, today I'm sitting here with over $600 a month in pension. It all came through organized labor. At my old age, I'm able to sit around and do what I want. They got 40 years of me down there, the best of my life, and now I'm able to enjoy every little bit of it. And if we hadn't struck, we wouldn't have had nothing. We had to do it. And that's the end of that story called A Striking New Tactic. And now I have a little bit of time to read some questions written into Smithsonian Magazine. The first one is, did James Madison switch over from the Federalists to the Democratic Republicans? The answer is no, though Madison advocated a stronger national government, and though he was an author of the series of articles published as the Federalist Papers, he was never a member of the Federalist Party. When America's first political parties formed during the Washington administration, Madison and Thomas Jefferson helped form the Democratic Republicans. In fact, Madison opposed the Federalists, who were led by Alexander Hamilton, John Adams, and John Marshall, in his insistence that the central government's powers remain limited and enumerated. And I guess that's probably all the time we have for today. So I'll stop there and want to thank you for listening to Smithsonian Magazine. Until the next time, have a great week.